I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opyongo Line. We're here today to help celebrate Canada Day, or it was originally called 154 years ago, Dominion Day. It was on that day, July 1st, 1867, that Canada first emerged as an independent nation. But it's also a day that today, in 2021, may not engender much of a celebratory feeling. It's not been easy to wake up in Canada and discover that our country's history is not all that it's cracked up to be. Indeed, the recent discovery of two unmarked grave sites containing nearly 1,000 Indigenous children, once students at religious residential schools, seems only the beginning of an evolving nightmare bound to get worse as more grave sites are likely to be revealed in the coming months. Still, we'd ask you to listen to the words of that very wise young man who brought us only last week the latest tragic news from his little village in Saskatchewan. We all inherited this. Nobody today created residential schools. Nobody today created the Indian Act. Nobody today created the 60 scoop. But we all inherited it. And we just have to acknowledge that people are healing. People are hurting. Let's do something about it. Those words were spoken by Cadmus Delorme, the chief of the Kowessis First Nation, located 200 kilometers east of Regina, where 751 unnamed remains of mostly children were found buried. "Let's do something about it," he said. Indeed, let's do something about it. So, we here at the Opyongo Line thought today, of all days, would be a good day to start taking our first baby steps by doing something, by going back to Dominion Day, 1867, and, in so doing, look at how this country got born. It was certainly not a day many of us may know very much about, and for that reason, we thought we'd call upon Art Milne and Sean Conway, both who know a thing or two about the signing of the British North America Act on that fateful day, July 1st, 1867. It was a hot and grimy Monday, that much we do know, a sweltering day, perhaps profoundly moving for some, but for others, if the truth must be known, and it must, it was also a day of almost slapstick comedy. It was, after all, a day organized by our very fallible Fathers of Confederation. Sean Conway and Art Milne are two old friends who you've heard on this podcast before. They both have very intriguing ways of making history come alive with their curious anecdotes and sometimes unbelievable facts that turn out to be only too true. For instance, did you know that Jefferson Davies, the Johnny Rebel president of the Confederate States who had freshly been sent packing after his defeat in the American Civil War, well, he gave a Dominion Day speech in 1867 in, of all places, Canada. Or take that 21-gun salute planned for Ottawa that first Dominion Day. It ended up raining steel bayonets down on the crowd gathered on Parliament Hill. Many of you will remember Art Milne from the show we did last year at this time. A former reporter of the Pembroke Observer, Art also worked as a speechwriter for more than a few Canadian prime ministers, and he's been a friend and confidant of more than one American president, to say little of having high tea in the British House of Lords with Margaret Thatcher. Sean Conway, on the other hand, has had a long and distinguished career in Canadian politics, having served as Ontario Minister of Education, as well as having taught at St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto. It also doesn't hurt that he's been on the campaign trail with more than a few Canadian prime ministers, or that he's known far and wide as the Dean of Local Historians here in the Ottawa Valley. These two old friends met in Kingston, overlooking Art's rather unique backyard garden, complete with more than a half a dozen young trees, all individually planted by almost every living Canadian Prime Minister and at least one U.S. President. Let's join them now among the rustling leaves, twittering birds, and occasional police sirens along the streets of Kingston.
Well, since it's Canada Day, let's get something on the table from my perspective. It's Dominion Day. I'm a history teacher, father's son. And this Canada Day stuff, I'll meet people halfway. I'll call it Dominion Canada Day, but it will always be Dominion Day to me.
That's a good point of departure. Do you know, because the word Dominion sounds a little bit old-fashioned, but it certainly wasn't to the men. Sadly, they were all men, the fathers of Confederation. Do you know anything about the origins of the phrase, the word Dominion, and how it came to be? Because it wasn't the first choice of the Fathers of Confederation. They had offered Queen Victoria, once the deal had been made at the third of the constitutional conferences that gave birth to the new federal state that was to be called Canada, they wanted the Queen to allow them to call or style her new arrangement in British North America the Kingdom of Canada.
And they didn't like the title of Governor General.
And do you remember what they wanted in its stead?
Just like India, they wanted the Governor General to be a Viceroy of this new land.
A Viceroy. They wanted the Governor General of the new Canada to be called Viceroy, because these men, again, sadly, no women in this group. But the word Dominion, and if memory serves me correctly, was offered up by the very serious, teetotaling, church-going, and these were mostly church-going men of the mid-19th century, Premier of New Brunswick, later the longtime Minister of Finance for Canada in those early years, Leonard Tilley. And it makes the point as to where their mindset was. The word Dominion is derived from the 72nd Psalm, and he shall seek dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth, is, I think, a pretty accurate quotation or summary of the psalm. And the point about that, and I'm sure it wasn't everybody's cup of tea, but it speaks to the optimism that these mostly middle-class men this part of the world brought to their task of making a new country that on the face of it seemed like a laughable impossibility.
I've always found the word Dominion to be almost uniquely Canadian and in itself patriotic. But like you just said, choosing that name shows, the quote from the Bible, from sea to sea, that these Fathers of Confederation gathering on this date on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, they were already looking to the Pacific coast, a Pacific coast none of them had seen.
That's correct. And the maker of the deal, that was Canada 1867, John Alexander Macdonald, the Member of Parliament in 1867, that he had been for at that point 23 years, the Member of Parliament for a place called Kingston, where we happen to be chatting this afternoon. Macdonald, I don't think, saw the Pacific. I think he saw it only once.
1886,
that's correct. Can you imagine, by the way, what that must have felt like when he got off that train and looked at the Pacific? This young man who was born in Scotland, he was an old man in 1886, but who had been born in 1886, Arthur. He was, 71 years of age?
Yep.
And he had traveled across the North Atlantic when he was... how old was he when he came to Canada? Something like
5 years
five years of age. He'd crossed the North Atlantic around 1820, and now he'd crossed the vast reaches of British North America, Canada, in that famous train trip of 1886.
So what's interesting about that 1886 trip that he takes to the Pacific, the only time he ever did, was he did write about it in his final election manifesto to the Canadian people. And he spoke of the pride and patriotic feelings of seeing, like he did, the Rocky Mountains, quote, fringing the eastern sky. And what a journey that must have been for the Father of Confederation.
Well, Arthur, speech by Sir John in 1886 recalls a famous speech made by probably the best orator of that whole generation, at least in the English language in British North America, Thomas Darcy McKee, who said in this period around 1867, quote, "I see in the not remote distance one great nationality bound like the shield of Achilles by the blue rim of ocean," etc., etc. Macdonald, who had spent some jolly good times with his friend, the Irishman, Thomas Darcy McGee.
Didn't Macdonald once say that the government can only afford one drunk, so you have to stop drinking,
Darcy? That's certainly part of the lore, and I believe it to be true.
Sean, take me to Parliament Hill, July 1st, 1867. Am I right to assume that, in terms of national capitals, Ottawa is no Paris, London, or Rome? Would I be correct in that?
Arthur, you're very correct in that. Ottawa is a shanty town described by a prominent English academic visiting Canada as a, quote, subarctic lumber village. Just to give you an idea of the size of Ottawa, Ottawa is Pembroke. Pembroke, Ontario, today's got a population of about 16,000. The population of Ottawa on this Dominion Day, July 1st, 1867, is approximately 16,000 people. It's been a newly created capital for the last few years. And think of a lumber town, a rough and rambunctious lumber town, some not bad buildings, but a lot of shanties and what you'd expect in a mid-19th century lumber area, which is what Ottawa was. Ottawa was the capital of a huge, thriving lumber economy in central Canada. But because it's the new capital, there is at Barracks Hill, what we know today as Parliament Hill, a spectacular collection of Gothic architectural wonders. And you know, it must have been something if you'd walked in from a farm in Carleton County, or come down from Arnprior or Renfrew, or up from Cornwall or Perth, to see that spectacle of in this rough and ready town that wasn't taken very seriously by a lot of people, particularly middle-class opinion makers in mid-19th century, to see what in fact they had built on Barracks Hill between that time when the Prince of Wales laid the cornerstone for the complex in 1860 till they actually moved in 1865. I might add, these three buildings were expected to cost $500,000, and the cost overrun was nine times that. I think the bill at the end of the day was something like $4.5 million.
They stopped construction for a year.
Oh, they stopped. They had to have an investigation, and surprise, surprise, they found that there was some funny business with the letting of contracts, and that politics and patronage seemed to color some of those awards. But it was a beautiful set of buildings, as it is today, against the backdrop of the Laurentian Hills to the northeast. And it was there, on that park-like setting, that was made so much more attractive just a few years later, when the very famous American landscaped architect Frederick Olmsted, the fellow who created Central Park in New York, came and polished off Parliament Hill to more or less what it looks like today, with obviously some significant additions.
Well, if I'm from Arnprior and I came in for the day, I know it's hot and dusty, I know that, or that day was. When I get to Parliament Hill, I understand I spend part of the day dodging bayonets.
Well, yes, and I know, Arthur, I'm going to let you tell this story, because it was a national holiday. And there weren't too many national holidays in mid-19th century or Victorian Canada. It was a Monday, so it was a long weekend, and the weather was particularly favorable, particularly so in the what we now call the national capital area, the whole Ottawa area, hot, dusty, and it was a 24-hour event. There were military displays. There were... think of it as just one big picnic. The formal part that we'll talk about in a moment was actually inside what we know as the Eastern Departmental Block, the East Block, but there were thousands of people around and about the core of Ottawa, as there were, for example, Market Square here in Kingston, thousands of people gathered in town squares all across British North America. With decidedly less enthusiasm in places like Halifax, where I should add at this point the Halifax Chronicle headline of July 1st was, if I'm not mistaken, the headline, "Died, a free and independent Nova Scotia." More about that later. But Ottawa on Canada Day was a pretty happy place because this lumber town was by fiat of the Queen Victoria, the head of the British Empire, at this point on its way to being the greatest empire that had been, was being transformed from this rough and ready lumber town to a seat of government. And as we know, in the intervening 154 years, government has been a growth industry. And there's a wonderful story reported in the Ottawa Citizen in 1927 of a woman who was, I think, in her was 18 years of age or thereabouts. She walked with a girlfriend and two young gentlemen from Merivale Heights, 8 miles to the southwest, sort of southwest of Parliament Hill, to take in the festivities. They walked through the night because there were bands, there were military displays, there was a great festive mood, and of course it was this Monday, July 1st, a national holiday. And I'll let you tell the story, Arthur. The military, both in Ottawa and across the land, played a very important role in headlining the celebrations. They made much noise to let the world know a new baby was born. That baby was the Dominion of Canada, and let the world take note, and particularly let the United States of America take note.
Well, my favorite vision of July 1st, 1867, is the militia on Spark Street firing a salute to the new country and forgetting to take their bayonets off their muskets. So the crowd gets bayonets raining on them, and I can't get that out of my head. What's your favorite glimpse, Sean, of that day?
Well, it just, people need to think party, just a big party. It was a Monday, beautiful weather, and there were a lot of highfalutin people, but they were actually signing papers in the East Block up on this beautiful new Gothic architectural complex that we know as Parliament Hill. But for the regular folks of Ottawa and Hull across the river, and valley places like Arnprior and Perth and Smiths Falls, they were coming in to participate in just a big long weekend party.
The other thing I love about that day on Parliament Hill is how the head cheese, the Grand Poobah, the Governor General, he doesn't really care. He just shows up in his business suit. And it's just another day for him.
Yes, and one of the things he does is he, on behalf of the British Queen Victoria, he hands out honors, and he gives a higher honor to Johnny MacDonald than the very important Quebec politician, Georges-Étienne Cartier, who is very ticked off when he gets a slightly lower title than his longtime colleague, MacDonald, and tension begins on day one of this new government in this new thing called the Dominion of Canada.
And the other thing that is actually more serious, particularly today, but our American neighbors basically ignore this event. Andrew Johnson's the president, a rough guy from Tennessee, likes to drink. He couldn't care less. But the former American president, who did care, happened to be living in Quebec at the time. So, Sean, what the heck is Jefferson Davis doing in Quebec?
Well, as I remember, Jefferson Davis, and let's be clear, he was the president of the Southern Confederacy.
Yes.
He was the rebel president who had just lost the American Civil War. He was in Canada because, as I understand it, one of his kids was at school in the Sherbrooke area of Quebec.
Yeah, and the Canadians were excited to host Davis, and we don't talk about it a lot today, but we were the future Canadians, very sympathetic to the Confederacy. And Davis is met on July 1st or 2nd, right in this period, at a train by crowds of Canadians, and they want his view on the new country, and he's a hero, and he says to them, stay firm to your British principles, and I wish you the best.
Well, that's really interesting about Jefferson Davis, just defeated president of the American Confederacy in the bloody, bloody American Civil War, which had just ended, being here that very day giving a speech up in Quebec City. But you know, the other image I have of Ottawa during this celebratory long weekend is, as I said earlier, just imagine this beautiful Parliament Hill that's taking shape. But it's kind of a park. It's set aside, really, from the rest of Ottawa. And Ottawa at this time is a small place, as I say, a city of about 16,000. There's Lower Town, where a lot of working class French Canadians and an Irish, you know, navvies, they were called, people that had built the Rideau Canal and that tried to bust their way into the Ottawa River timber trade.
I remember reading that, you know, if you were a contractor back then and you'd need to hire a bunch of guys, and they were guys, to work on the Parliament buildings or on a canal, they even had to split them by French wouldn't work with English. English wouldn't work with French. Catholics wouldn't work with Protestants. Protestants wouldn't work with Catholics. And nobody wanted to work with the Irish. Like, what a mess this place started.
Well, it was, you know, it was a different time. It was the 19th century. People, issues like religious difference, language differences were pretty sensitive. But just for the moment, recall Lower Town, which is where it is today. Then there's this new suburb where middle-class professionals are living in Sandy Hill. There is the Upper Town, which is the area in sort of, you know, just straight south of Parliament Hill through what we now know as the Glebe. And then there's the Industrial District of Ottawa, which is Le Breton Flats and the Chaudière. This place, there's sawmills, there's lumber piled everywhere, there's sawdust everywhere at or near the rivers. There's a lot of noise. We have all kinds of evidence from visiting dignitaries that it's hard to get a good night's sleep in Ottawa because the whining of saws, the banging of industrial operations down on Le Breton Flats or around
and aren't I right that floating down from the valley is lumber, lumber, lumber floating by that Parliament buildings? And don't they build some of the interior of the building with valley wood?
Well, that's a great point, because if you looked at, and that's what I want people to think about, if you can imagine in this shanty town, this shack town, where there were some nice buildings, but they were the exception. This wasn't going to make the architectural digest, except for this magnificent set of buildings that are newly built at a very significant cost overrun, I might add, up on what we now know as Parliament Hill. But if you got inside, if you looked at those buildings from the outside, a lot of that stone came from places like Carleton County, Nepean. Some of the stone, as I understand it, came either from upstate New York,
Potsdam, New York. Went to university,
but if you walked inside the center block, you would have seen beautiful, beautiful lumber, pine, the best pine in the world, likely. And the person who delivered a lot of that pine was the great king of the Ottawa lumber economy of that time, John Rodolphus Booth. And if you're like I am from the Upper Ottawa Valley, there's a very good chance that that beautiful pine that you can still see in the Parliamentary Library came from along the Madawaska River between Arnprior and Barry's Bay, although some of it probably came from Carleton County as well. So, lumber was a big part of this town. And by the way, if you were around Parliament Hill for the celebrations of the formal kind, you might have run into the government member of Parliament for Renfrew South, a guy named Daniel McLaughlin from Arnprior. You might have met Alonzo Wright, another government-supporting member, that is a supporter of Johnny Macdonald and George Etienne Cartier, Alonzo Wright from the Gatineau, Peter White from Pembroke, another lumber king, Senator George Bryson from Fort Calunge. There were a lot of lumber men in the House of Commons and the Senate making the point that the lumber economy was a big part of the economy, not just of Ottawa and the Ottawa Valley, but of Canada at Confederation.
Well, the other thing that fascinates me about all this are the characters involved. So we're in Kingston. Who's this MacDonald guy who sets the whole thing up?
Well, MacDonald was then, as he is today for many people, a very controversial character. I mean, he was, you know, and the cartoons make the point. If you look at the cartoon literature of the 19th century, Johnny MacDonald is always, not always, but often portrayed as the artful dodger, the sorcerer, the schemer, but also the guy who could make things happen. Because as you just said a moment ago, Arthur, Canada, if you looked at it, 3.3 million people, one third of whom were in the province of Quebec, 1 million of the 3.3 million people at Confederation spoke French. They were overwhelmingly Roman Catholic. Ontario, on the other hand, which is a province created at Confederation, but it had been known earlier as Canada West or Upper Canada, was a fast-growing place, much more Protestant, almost entirely Anglophone. And there was a very large Irish population in Canada, and two-thirds of it was located in what we know as Ontario. But the Irish population was 70% Irish Protestant and 30% Irish Catholic, and they had what my old friend Bill Davis would have called a relationship characterized by creative tension, to put it politely. So you had a lot of division, you had a lot of difference, and the Parliament that preceded Dominion Day 1867 had simply collapsed.
Well,
on all
that,
of these lines of difference.
Well, more than that, Sean, we don't talk about it up here too much anymore in Canada, but particularly last January when the Americans were attacking, a group of Americans were attacking the Capitol, shocking the world on international TV. Well, we did that, didn't we?
Well, yes, one of the great unknown stories of Canadian history, not that historians haven't made a good effort to tell the story, is that, you know, in April of 1849, at one of the earliest and certainly the most significant points where democratic government was initiated, what happened? Well, Parliament was meeting in Canada's biggest city, Montreal, and the Parliament of the day, representing both Ontario and Quebec, it was the Union Parliament, they had passed something called the Rebellion's Losses Bill, and they had done that in two parts. They passed...
Yeah, in Ontario, it was no problem.
In
right?
Ontario, it was no problem, but it certainly was a problem when they did it for Lower Canada or Quebec in 1849.
Well, what I love about it, it's not the rabble-rousing French Canadians who burned down the Parliament buildings. It's the English.
Well, that's correct. It's the very angry English business community in the main that was so furious about what this was doing, because a lot of Anglophones, not just in Quebec but in Ontario, looked at this and said, "My God, we're taking public money and we're rewarding these French Canadians who rebelled in 1837-38." And you said it. Let me repeat. They got so angry. You know, the gang in Washington on January the 6th, 2021, they attacked the Capitol, but they didn't destroy the Capitol. The great riot of the Rebellion Losses riot in Montreal in April 25th, I think it was, 1849, started out as loud and noisy, it ended with the rioters, mostly Anglophones, and many of them very prominent or sons of prominent folks. They succeeded in burning the Parliament buildings to the ground.
Well, the other thing I love is the hero of when we burned down the Parliament buildings, the heroes, the British aristocrat.
That's right, Lord Elgin, you know, who didn't like certain aspects of the legislation that he was signing, but he did so on the basis that, you know, responsible government, democratic government, now means what it has meant at this point, this is 1849, so it's a few months since the British Imperial Government said this is the new order in the colonies, that if your parliament says this is what we want, I'm honor bound to give it to you, and you will live with the consequences. And that sounded a lot better than it felt for a lot of the Anglophone minority. Now, in fairness, just to make a quick point, that the late 1840s were a time of particular economic hardship in Canada. So you have to understand this riot and this burning of the Parliament buildings as in part a reflection of particularly hard economic times. But nonetheless, I don't know how many Canadian students realized that as they looked at that attack on the U.S. Capitol in January of 2021, there was a Canadian antecedent for that, and it didn't end very well.
Well, when I think of all that, it's what I find every Canada Day, and today's the 154th one. What I find inspiring about it all is these, McDonald, just a lawyer from Kingston. We got a druggist in New Brunswick. We have Cartier. We have my favorite, and if I remember, Sean, you're the first who ever told me about him. Am I right that one of the Fathers Confederation, Wandering Willie McDougall, was actually on the podium at Gettysburg when Lincoln delivers the Gettysburg Address?
Well, somewhere along the line I was told that, and William McDougall was a lawyer and a journalist from Toronto who was a radical liberal, a clear grit, who nonetheless thought that the Union Parliament was a disaster, it couldn't work, and they had to find a new arrangement. And he agreed with his leader, George Brown, who yelled and screamed and wrote incessantly from almost the time he arrived in Canada in the mid-1840s that this French domination of English Canadians simply was intolerable and it had to stop. And in a sense, Canada Day, 1867, is an act of separation because the New Deal creates a federal state where the previous arrangement was a unitary state. There were no provinces. It was all one.
Well, I got to admit, Sean, some days throughout my life as a Canadian, I shouldn't say this, but I kind of wish we had a unitary government.
Well, you might until you actually have to try to govern.
Yeah, exactly.
What they did, they I think rightly concluded that the issues that were tearing the country apart before Confederation were issues of language and culture and religion. So they transferred a lot of those to the provinces. So Quebec, if you're a French Canadian Catholic, you don't have to worry any longer that George Brown, that really aggressive Presbyterian who is editing the great newspaper of Western Canada, which is the area around Toronto and mostly Ontario, if he got his way, he was going to end, for example, Catholic schools. Well, that didn't sit very well with a million French Canadians living in Quebec. So
where do you stand on that? Do you think George Brown doesn't get enough credit?
Well, I think Brown deserves more credit than he gets because, let's be clear, all politics is personal, and Johnny MacDonald and George Brown were two Scotsmen who were very active in Canadian public affairs. MacDonald gets elected to Parliament in 1844. That's about the year that George Brown and his father come to Canada via New York City to establish few months after they get here, the Globe, and Brown is in politics almost immediately. But they came to hate one another. They could not stand one another. And one of the reasons, actually, why they disliked one another so much is that Brown was involved with a royal commission investigating
the
Kingston Penitentiary in 1849, I think it was, and MacDonald never forgave him for what he thought was a completely personal attack on Kingston and some of MacDonald's good friends in Kingston. But there was a great degree of genuine dislike between these two very important figures.
Both Scotsmen.
but it was Brown who, 3 years before this Canada Day, Dominion Day, July 1st, 1867, who said, listen, we can't make this Union Parliament work. there were 8 different governments in the space of about 22 years, and they all just fell apart because you couldn't get a majority to do what people felt needed to be done. So when that failure occurred in 1864, there was something called the Great Coalition. Brown led a group of liberals from Ontario into a coalition with Macdonald and Cartier to see if they could find a solution that basically they thought involved the federation, they called it the federative principle, the notion of federalism as opposed to a unitary state, which was no provinces. And that was the basis of the deal that gave us Canada, 1867.
For me, one of my, you know, bucket list things that I've always said I'm going to do is sit down one day, it'll take me months, but I want to learn more about all of these fathers of Confederation. I know about Macdonald. I know a bit about McGee. But I mean, I remember years ago, Sean, you told me about one of our fathers of Confederation traveled to Washington, William McDougall, and he ends up, Lincoln takes him to the Gettysburg Address. Lincoln himself on the train. Like, who are these guys? Who are the fathers? Who are they?
Well, they're an interesting group. They're all men, many of them, as I say, are now in this federal cabinet. We talked earlier about John A. Macdonald. Let me just say one last word about Macdonald. I think that's really important. The genius of John A. Macdonald was he was the one politician, more than any other, the 1850s and 60s, particularly in Ontario, who understood that you couldn't have a stable national government
without Quebec, without French Canadians.
French Canadians. I mean, George Brown used the pages of the Globe and Mail to denounce the Quebecers as priest-ridden, backward-looking, in the thrall of the Pope of Rome. Well, you know, you just simply cannot get a stable government in a place where now with democratic government, you've got, you know, 1.7 million people in Ontario and 1.4 million people, 1.5 million in Quebec, 1 million of whom are French Canadians. How do you actually get them into a government and keep the place running if you spend all your time denouncing the French Canadians as a defeated race? And
to me, yeah, I agree.
So that's the genius of Macdonald, and that's why that's the nature I think of his essential greatness. McGee is an interesting character because McGee is one of the very few people from the Canadas, Upper and Lower Canada, Ontario, who actually knows the Maritimes.
And the United States.
He's lived in the United States for the 10 years before he came to Canada. But McGee in the mid-1860s makes a number of trips into Nova Scotia and New Brunswick talking up a new arrangement. And poetically in some cases. But critically, McGee understands the people that are coming to the table from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland. Both of the last two don't join the deal.
Well, I have two favorite stories about McGee. One is somebody asked his wife once about was she worried about him straying because he was away on the road in politics in places like Kingston and stuff like that for so long, and she said, no, he's too ugly. and you know, this is his wife says this, right? And my other with Darcy, old Darcy McGee. Back in my day in the press gallery on the hill, we used to have this crazy party at the press club on Spark Street where he was shot. We would party at the press club and then lay a wreath at McGee's the spot on Spark Street where McGee was shot. But I also, you know, I also love McGee when both McGee, as you know, Sean, both McGee and Macdonald had a bit of a love of the bottle.
They did. But in fairness to both McGee and Macdonald, Canada in the mid-19th century was a place where a lot of people liked the bottle. I mean, there was a lot of beer and alcoholic beverages consumed. And by the way, the role of alcohol in making the deal that brought about the Dominion of Canada in 1867 possible was real. I mean,
it was a political issue.
Yes, Darcy McGee has been very fortunate to get an outstandingly good biographer. I happen to know him, and I teach with him at the University of Toronto, David Wilson. And Wilson said of Darcy McGee that he's best understood as the social convener of Confederation. His wit, says Dr. Wilson, sparkled as brightly as the wine. And there was a lot of wine and champagne flowing around these very difficult constitutional conferences at Charlottetown and Quebec, and then later in London. So McGee McGee's importance, his importance is he speaks for a lot of the Irish, particularly the Irish Catholic community, because McGee and Alexander Tillich Galt, another father of Confederation, Galt is important because, like McGee, Galt is the financial man. For this deal. Galt understands money, he understands finances, and he becomes a very important part of the arrangement for that prowess. But he's also an important Anglophone representative from Quebec, and the Anglo-Protestants in Quebec, like the Irish Catholics in Ontario, are concerned about minority educational rights, because education is the vehicle through which issues of language and culture are conveyed. So people sometimes ask, well, why on earth would Canadians have separate schools? Well, ask yourself this question. Your Alexander Tillich Galt, another one of these very interesting fathers of Confederation. No, I guess he wasn't a father of Confederation, but he made the best speech about the Quebec resolutions that give rise to the British North America Act, Christopher Duncan. Imagine being a Christopher Duncan and a Galt, both of whom have roots in the eastern townships of Quebec, and someone saying to them, well, no, there's going to be for you Anglo-Protestants in Quebec, there'll be one school system, and it will be French-speaking and Roman Catholic. That was never going to be a deal. So Quebec had a duality that everybody understood. And then the really contentious issue was, and McGee and the Catholics, particularly in Ontario, were able to extract from that Union Parliament a provision for not just Roman Catholic separate schools, because the separate schools that were created before Confederation were not just for Roman Catholics. The Anglicans had them, the Congregationalists, there were other Protestant sects that qualified and had separate schools.
Well, Sean, let me cut in there, man, because didn't you tell me once that when you became Minister of Education, you discovered there was actually a separate legal Protestant school in your riding?
Yes, there was, and there were a number of places in Ontario well into the 20th century where there were separate schools that weren't Roman Catholic, because the idea was, again, it comes back to religion. It's hard in 2021 for Canadians to think about religion being as central to the life of the community or the life of the home. But take somebody like the great Scottish-born John Straughan, who actually, I think, dies the year of Confederation. But John Straughan was this powerful establishment figure, basically heading the Church of England in Ontario, and a real believer in education. But the idea for Straughan that you would compel people to go to a public school, which we started to do in Ontario, for example, around 1841, and allow those children to be taught by a Methodist? Because it was impossible in the 19th century for people to imagine that you could have an education without what they would have called a moral, we would call a religious, a sectarian surround. And so hence we got separate schools. Looking back from 2021, it looks a bit antique, but it sure didn't look antique in 1865, 66, 67, because one of the issues that threatened to pull this coalition apart was exactly how far to go with the protection of minority school rights. But anyway, Galt is all about protecting and enhancing the educational school rights of Anglophones in Quebec. McGee, working with a very prominent Irish Catholic politician who was the MP for Ottawa, whose great-great-grandson I served with at Queen's Park, Ian Scott, but Richard W. Scott was responsible for separate school legislation in 1863 that gets embedded in the British North America Act and protected constitutionally. So you've got these two important characters, but then you've got others. We talked briefly about
well, I
Tupper.
Cut in. I was going to say, I want to talk
Tupper.
About my favorites, Tupper,
oh,
right?
Dr. Charles Tupper.
And one of his biographers, I just stumbled on this the other day, and I just love this. This is the best description of Tupper, like you said, Dr. Tupper. Well, there's two great descriptions of him. But
he was a medical doctor, so...
Oh, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And he was also, as a medical student, he was caught digging up a body out of a graveyard because he couldn't afford to pay the fee at the Scottish Medical School so he could dissect bodies. So he dug one up. But one of his biographers said, I just stumbled on this recently, said, Charles was loved for the humanitarian, caring doctor that he was, and he could amputate, negotiate, and debate with equal skill.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Tupper. Charles Tupper was an amazing character. Suffice it to say, his colleagues of the day, if they were here today, would say, and oh, that Charlie, he had a full and very robust social life. He was in Nova Scotia, where he was king of the castle for many, many decades. He was affectionately known as the Ram of Cumberland County. I will leave that to the imagination of the listening audience. But Charles Tupper had a long and really interesting career. He's Prime Minister of Canada briefly, 30 years after this Confederation arrangement, and he's still going as leader of the Conservative Party in the early days and years of the 20th century.
And my favorite is, after his 66 days as Prime Minister, like you just referenced, the guy stays on. And like he's in his 70s and stuff. And my favorite is he checks into a hotel once in Brockville, and he always has his own special room. But this traveling salesman the same day checks in, and he has his own special room, which is where Tupper's crashed. And so the salesman is shocked to discover that the former Prime Minister is in his bed in the hotel, and he Tupper shouts out, I will have you pulled out of my room. And the salesman says, ex-Prime Ministers have no pull.
Well, you know, that's so true. You know, one of the other characters, let's not forget, he's not in this first federal cabinet because he's, at this point, a high court judge. But one of the fathers of Confederation, who happens to have been born and raised in Kingston, and becomes a really important figure in the early years of Confederation, is the nearly blind, mutton-chopped Oliver Mowat, who started his professional life here in Kingston as a law student articled to the firm of John A. Macdonald.
I love when they got into fisticuffs.
Well,
the
they
legislature,
did. Oh, they did. And, you know, it's interesting because Macdonald and Mowat, how different they were. I mean, Macdonald, again, back to the cartoon imagery of Macdonald, which wasn't too inaccurate. He had a nice big shock of curly hair. He had the cartoonist loved his very large nose. He was a stylish dresser, he was a rogue. He had a roguish personality. People loved him. Women particularly liked Macdonald, it must be said, according to a lot of
yeah, he wasn't like D'Arcy McGee. He wasn't that ugly.
No, he certainly, John, and he looked like the British politician Benjamin Disraeli. He was once mistaken for Disraeli on one of his many trips to London. On the other hand, Oliver Mowat, well, if you met Oliver Mowat, you'd be forgiven for thinking he was just a clerk in a shoe store. I mean, he couldn't see very well. You know, he was unprepossessing physically.
How does he stay in office as premier for a quarter century?
Well, he becomes Premier of Ontario in 1872 and stays there for 24 years, the most successful premier in Ontario's history. And Johnny Macdonald was not a good hater. But I'll tell you, it would be a good question as to whom he detested more than the two Scotsmen, George Brown and Oliver Mowat. And I think he detested Mowat more than he detested Brown, because Brown never was in government. Well, right. He was. He was so unstable were those pre-Confederation governments that George Brown was actually co-premier of the province of Canada, Ontario and Quebec, in the summer of 1858 for 48 hours.
Yeah.
He formed a government with A.A. Dorion, I think it was, and the only unifying principle of that government was they could not stand Johnny McDonald. They couldn't stand him. Of course, they had no positive program. But Mowat turned out to be a very formidable opponent of McDonald when he became Premier of Ontario. And I don't want to get into too much detail, but one of the other things I should say is that in 1861, after the famous royal tour of Canada by the then Prince of Wales, later Edward the Seventh, it didn't go well in Ontario because the future,
here in Kingston.
Oh, it was terrible in Kingston. And what happened in that story was the Macdonald was the Macdonald or the Cartier-Macdonald government. So he's not only the member of the pre-Confederation Union Parliament, but he's also the MPP for Kingston City. The future king is having a grand, it's the first big royal tour, and it is a very big deal, and nowhere more so than in Kingston, or so it was planned.
Where the Orangemen gathered.
And the Orange Order, I've talked earlier about how big and how important was the Irish population. Think of, you know, an Irish population in 1860 in Ontario at probably at least 300,000-500,000, and most of them were Irish Protestants, and most of those Irish Protestants were either in the Orange Order or certainly closely associated people that were. Well, the Duke of Newcastle, who's traveling with the young future king, the Prince of Wales, makes it known that he is simply not going to allow the future king to come ashore in Kingston, though he's been in various Catholic convents and other churches and such like in Quebec, because in the United Kingdom,
the Orange Lodge is
illegal. Well, tell that to 15,000 Orangemen gathered around the harbor of Kingston City. And in fact, the king does not, the future king, the then Prince of Wales, is not allowed to land on the advice of the...
The Orangemen riot.
No, the Orangemen have a complete fit. So Mowat is not part of that, but there's an election. There's a what we would call a Dominion election. It wasn't a Dominion election, but it was an election of the... of the parliament that was Ontario and Quebec.
Let me just tell you though,
in this sense, Mowat really infuriates Macdonald because the election comes within months of this exquisitely painful embarrassment in Kingston, and Mowat comes down to Kingston to run against Macdonald.
Yeah.
And just before the election starts, they're both in that Union Parliament. Macdonald one night has perhaps a little bit too much to drink, and he gets so mad he actually tries to go and physically punch.
You damn pup, I'll smack your chops.
Yes,
I still love it. It's my
great
favorite
story.
What I've been thinking is, we started off talking about July 1st, 1867. Well, when the founding fathers wake up the next morning, and the party's over, and everybody's back to work. What's this new country facing?
Well, I can tell you what these people are facing, these so-called Fathers of Confederation, many of them who are in this first coalition, part liberal, part conservative new government, they're facing the first election in the Dominion Parliament, which is a six-week affair running from about the middle of early August till the latter part of July. There are 182 members to be elected. One election can't even be held. The rioting in Kamaraska in eastern Quebec is so great that election actually gets postponed for 2 years.
Well, take me back. What's a election rally look like in Pembroke or Kingston?
How did they do politics? Well, it was a contact sport, shall we say. I mean, first of all, the first election of the new Dominion of Canada was like previous elections. There was no such a thing as a secret ballot. It was a very limited franchise. A typical riding in 1867, a rural riding, might have no more than 2,000 qualified electors.
Well, hang on a sec. you're telling me that when I voted in 1867, I didn't do it in private?
Oh,
so
no,
everybody
no.
knew how I voted?
Oh,
what
absolutely.
The hell's that?
Well, that was democracy. You know, the manliness of the time would suggest, are you, Arthur Mills, afraid to go and declare yourself publicly?
What if my boss is the candidate, but I don't want to vote for him?
Well, that's a very good question.
So what happens to me when I don't vote for him?
Well, you basically, in most cases, did the prudent thing, and you, with your employer looking. And you might, your employer might be on the ballot. That's right. It didn't have to be, but he could have an agent on the ballot. What happened was that you were intimidated into voting for your employer, your landlord, your... you know, somebody else in your life that...
I guess the good news, though, wouldn't it be true that candidates might encourage me to vote for them with booze?
Oh, liquor and money. I mean, bribery and corruption. One of my great professors at Queen's University, sadly now long dead, Donald Swainson, gave a great lecture at Queen's a few decades ago talking about, the elections of the mid-19th century. He talks about, for example... some elections in this period where, for example, the voters list, think about this, a voters list in a Quebec riding where on the ballot, or on the voters list, that means they've been approved and eligible to vote, George Washington, Judas Iscariot.
How did Judas vote?
Napoleon Bonaparte. Well, we can imagine that the party in power controlled the election process. They appointed the returning officers. They decided where the polling station was going to be. There were ridings, again, in French Quebec, where there would be one poll.
So you're telling me...
It would be inside or outside the Orange Lodge. Well, so, that wouldn't...
So you're telling me the government in power... controlled the voters list, decided who could vote, who couldn't vote, and there was no Elections Canada.
There was no Elections Canada. No, this was.
When does that happen, by the way?
Well, that evolves over time, and the as I recall, that those elections that the first it's a bit like in the United States that it took a while before a national election. Was nationalized. You could have circumstances, if I'm not mistaken, in those early elections, the provincial rules applied. So, for example, in Nova Scotia, I think I'm right in this, and I might stand corrected on it, but it was nothing like it is today. I mean, the main concerns were there was vast amounts of money spent. By political parties.
There was no donation limits.
There was and then if there were appeals to elections, the appeal was heard by a committee of the House of Commons.
And am I right that also it seems so bizarre today? But there wasn't one election day.
Oh no. Let's come back to just on this, that it was clear going into this election cycle after the parties over on Ottawa and on Parliament Hill in July the 1st, 1867, this deal is very unpopular in places. Most especially in Nova Scotia, the Nova Scotians are furious. They're furious because unlike even in neighboring. In neighboring New Brunswick, where there have been two elections on the Quebec proposals in the period 1865 to 1867. The anti-Confederates won the first one, and when the British government basically went in through the office of the Lieutenant Governor and started to make plain to people, we want rid of you, so the status quo is not an option. And then the Fenians, these Irish revolutionary types from the United States threatened to invade, and by the way, they did invade, and we'll talk maybe more about that in a minute, but the anti-Confederates won the first New Brunswick election in 1865, and a year later, after the Fenians were rattling their sabers on the American border, and the lieutenant governor of New Brunswick was making it plain and manipulating vigorously behind the scenes. The anti-Confederates lost, and Leonard Tilley, the pro-Confederate premier, was returned in office. Charles Tupper, our friend, he was having nothing to do with having an election, because he knew that the Confederate proposals in Nova Scotia were very unpopular, and that Nova Scotia election was at the very end of the cycle. So think about it. You've got 182 seats in that first Dominion Parliament. 80% of those seats are in Ontario and Quebec. 82 in Ontario, and then down the line. And the government organizes the election going from best to worst. Right. So that by the time the Nova Scotians get to vote, and they get to vote at the end, I think it was mid-September of 1867, the election's over. MacDonald and
they
Cartier,
know the results.
Oh, they know the results. Yeah. And the government, the pro-Confederation government, has got about a 40-seat majority, which is significant and comfortable, as comfortable as it could be in an age of a lot of loose fish, you know. But when they get to vote in Nova Scotia, there are 19 seats in Nova Scotia. The vote's 18 anti-Confederate and one Confederate, and that's Charlie Tupper, and he's hanging on by a pretty small margin.
Well, my favorite scenes from this period on elections, or they both involve MacDonald, is he's campaigning, he and his opponent are speaking in a town square, his opponent's giving his views on the issue of the day, and MacDonald's had a few too many, and he leans over and vomits in front of the crowd. And I tell you, you do that, like, even Bill Clinton couldn't talk his way out of that one, but MacDonald stands up and says, "Sorry, folks, but that's what happens whenever I hear my opponent speak."
But you know, to be serious about this, elections mattered.
Yeah.
You know, it was a frontier community. It was developing. There were very sharp differences. Who got into government mattered if you were running the post office, because, you know, it was many years after Confederation, 1867, that the post office was considered a non-political position, that you qualified by virtue of your competency. You might have political views, but you were entitled to those. But in much of the 19th century, a lot of these government jobs, in with the party that won the election, out
like
with
the
party.
Americans.
That's correct.
Yeah.
There's a great story in my neck of the woods. I grew up in a place called Barry's Bay, Ontario, up in West Renfrew. In the next election, 1872, there was a great fight between essentially Irish Catholics who were asked to vote for a prominent Kingston lawyer named James O'Reilly, and the Liberal candidate was the incumbent, Scots Presbyterian from Renfrew named John Lorne McDougall. And I won't get into all the details, but just to show you how this election machinery worked, when the election was over, O'Reilly won by a rather handsome 225 votes. And remember, if you've got a constituency with only 1,500 votes, some of them even less than that, you didn't have to move very many votes to turn the tide in the election. So,
especially if you have Judas Iscariot.
Yeah, well, exactly. Judas Iscariot, exactly. So what happens when what they discover after the election, and it was known as the Battle of Brudenell, but there was a developing, this is right in the early days of Confederation, and that area up in southwest Renfrew, Barry's Bay and Combermere, that's all being, you know, settled. And so the voters list is a real issue. Who qualifies? So this became a contested election. We know this because after the election, there are some very good debates involving people like Johnny MacDonald and Edward Blake, the leader of the Liberal Party, probably the greatest lawyer in 19th century Canada, and a fellow named Sir Francis Hincks, who is the Minister of Finance, or was for Canada. He is the member of Parliament for North Renfrew, so he's somebody who knows something about this. But the story here is, so the voters list became a real issue. What happened was the returning officer for at least that west, southwest Renfrew area had been just 8 months before the census commissioner for those townships in West Renfrew. And by virtue of that document, there would have been only maybe 100, 150 maximum eligible voters. Well, guess what? The government candidate, O'Reilly, wins the riding by 200 and some votes, but his margin in the townships of Sherwood, Jones, and Burns, the greater Barry's Bay area, is something like 500. And the vote is O'Reilly, 450, McDougall, 5, or some outrageous number.
I still love how dead people voted.
And well, of course, dead people voted. And I don't want to sort of trivialize it because it could get very serious. People were killed in some of these elections.
Well, speaking of serious, we are in the era of reconciliation. So in this whole project called Confederation, where are the indigenous on July 1st, 1867?
Well, sadly, the indigenous people are not very much considered by a lot of these, recently arrived, settlers from places like England, Scotland, Ireland, United Empire loyalists from the United States. I mean, the relationship that the indigenous peoples have, which is real and strong, is with the British Crown.
With the Crown, yes.
And they feel, I think rightly so, that that is a protection that in the end is going to matter. We know that, sadly, it didn't. The Crown becomes, weaker in terms of the way in which politicians regarded its direction, and some very, very bad things happened. And one of those things happens very quickly in Confederation with the first Riel Rebellion, where you have the so-called half-breeds, the Métis, are just simply rolled over by a bunch of Ontarians part of the objective for the, particularly the liberals like George Brown of the Globe, the agricultural...
Assimilation, right?
Well, not so much assimilation. The agricultural frontier of Ontario and Quebec is pretty well filled out by the 1860s. So we have to get more land, more agricultural land. Well, what's out there? Well, what's out there is the vast territory that we knew as Rupert's Land, and we know today the Canadian Prairie is a very fertile place that grows very, very good crops. Well, there are two issues with that. One, there are thousands and thousands of indigenous peoples who've lived there from time immemorial. There are the so-called half-breeds. They're half, Caucasian. They're fur traders who went and had married indigenous women and then produced children of mixed race. So they're there as well. But not only do the Canadians, particularly the Ontarians, with agricultural and other economic interests want to get that land, but the post-Civil War Americans want it desperately. And there's a very real worry that we're going to wake up some morning, so the argument went, and the Americans will simply have moved in.
Oh, well, General Grant has, a million troops still under arms or something
huge,
like that?
A huge, huge army that, and again, McGee had a great way Darcy McGee had a great way distilling some of these issues. He went from platform to platform in the Confederation period, to those who were thinking, well, we don't need to change, we want the status quo. McGee said, well, listen, we, all of us up on this podium, these fathers of Confederation, we may not like it, but the British imperial policy towards the colonies has changed. They want rid of us. They've given us democratic government. We've now got free trade with the United States, the so-called reciprocity agreement, and the British government is saying, we're not paying for the defense of Canada anymore, particularly with this big long border with the usually hostile American Republic to the immediate south.
Well, I remember McGee, when he's on the ship coming back from the first Confederation conference in Charlottetown, and they get chased by a Confederate raider.
That's correct.
Right? In the Gulf of St. Lawrence.
And McGee says two things in this connection. He says, in one of these Confederation debates with a question of defense and protecting this fragile group of, this is a small group of people, 3.5 million people scattered across four disparate colonies, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Ontario and Quebec, essentially. McGee says at one point in this debate, if Canadians, he says, need a reason for their greater union, which is what he's arguing for, they need only look across the U.S. border and they will find reasons as thick as blackberries. In Ontario, in June of 1866, 1,000 Fenians, Irish, radical nationalists, cross the Canadian border. Many people are killed. and near Fort Erie, because and many of these invading Fenians had just been decommissioned from the Union Army. And these are recently arrived Irish immigrants to the United States. And for them, one of the great issues is England must be punished for the way she treats Ireland. We haven't got the resources to cross the North Atlantic and fight the English in England or Ireland, but we can fight John Bull up
right.
in Canada.
Just
and,
crossing the...
But the other thing, the other line that I really liked from McGee, thinking about the Canadian West and the fact that it was populated by relatively few, non-Indigenous peoples, in this period of 1867, 1870, 75, he says, remember, McGee, he says, the Americans coveted Florida and they seized it. They coveted Louisiana and they purchased it. They coveted Florida and they stole it. So if you think that our friends and neighbors in the United States are not as willing to do to us what they did in Texas and Louisiana, and
you better think again.
So,
well, that's what, again, I find, I keep saying this, but so inspiring about all this, is this same bunch, starting in 1867, they're already thinking about going all the way to the Pacific. It's remarkable.
That was Art Milne in conversation with Sean Conway, talking about Dominion Day, 1867. Time now for a short break, but we'll be right back.